You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Friday, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across North America, on Pacifica stations in America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. It is Friday, and so it's time for Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, although the good citizens of Vermont know he's their senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. I know that you've got a lot on your plate. You want to give us a snapshot?
Yeah, there's a whole lot that's taking place in Washington now that I think is of interest to the listeners. Number one, let's talk about something we've talked about many times in the past, and that is the status of the Postal Service. If I'm not mistaken, on Monday night we begin debate, finally, on a postal bill. As you know, and as we have discussed, over the last year, the Postal Service has come up with the idea that they thought it was best for the Post Office to shut down 3,700 rural post offices, which I think would be devastating to rural America. They wanted to shut down initially about half of the processing plants in this country. They wanted to slow mail delivery service, which I think in this day of instantaneous communications and emails would be just taking a step toward a death spiral. They also want to eliminate Saturday mail service. And the argument for all of this is that first-class mail is going down, which it certainly is. Being replaced by email. On the other hand, what I think the Postal Service has not been as strong as they might be in pointing out is that the Postal Service has been forced for a number of years now to put $5.5 billion into pre-health benefits for their retirees, a burden that no other agency of government requires, nor does anybody in the private sector. And in fact, with some $45 billion in that fund, they already have enough money to take care of all of their future needs. Also, what should be pointed out is the Postal Service has overpaid a variety of retirement programs, the Federal Employment Retirement Service, Civil Service Retirement Service, by some $13 billion. Point here is that the Postal Service has got to change in the digital age. Nobody argues that. But what we do argue is that in the midst of this terrible recession, it is not a good idea, A, to downsize the Postal Service, by as much as a couple of 100,000 jobs. We don't need that. And B, it does not make sense if we want a strong post office in the future to slow down mail delivery. Some of us think the alternative is the post office has got to be much more aggressive and entrepreneurial, figuring out new ways they can use their extraordinarily strong infrastructure. Today, letter carriers are going to be delivering mail to 150 million doors. We have rural post offices all over this country. How can they come up with a business model which generates more revenue? And that's an issue we are working on. The bill comes to the floor, I think, on Monday night. I and some other members of the Senate have been working hard to protect the post office, to protect workers' jobs, and not to see happen what the post office originally intended. We will keep you abreast as to how successful we will be, but I think we are making progress. The Postmaster General in the last couple of months has been talking for a start about shutting down far fewer processing plants and in trying to protect rural post offices, and we're working on some strong legislation.
That's great. But you know, the Republican argument, of course, is that the Postal Service is the largest unionized employer in the United States. We've got to kill that union off.
Well, I think that there's no question that some of these guys are certainly coming from that direction. But here's the story. The average postal employee, many of whom are veterans, by the way, earns a reasonable salary, and they get good benefits. And at a time when our middle class is evaporating and poverty is increasing, to my mind, it is absolutely imperative that we hang on to decent middle-class jobs and not see 100,000 or 200,000 of those jobs lost. So this is very much of an economic issue. Do we decrease the size of the postal force in the middle of recession? Do we make it a slower mail delivery system? Do we have a very negative impact in rural America? You talk to folks from rural America, from small towns, and they will tell you, you know what, the post office is the center of our town. That's where people gather. It's more than just, you know, picking up your mail. So I think we can come up with a program, a business model, which goes a long way to, A, addressing the real financial problems of the post office, which does exist. There's no question that email and the digital revolution has impacted mail, but we have a lot to learn from countries around the world who have made some significant transitions and understand that the post offices can expand what they are doing. I mean, for example, in rural America, post offices can do more than sell stamps. They can be involved in other government business. They can be delivering, letter carriers can be doing a lot more than they are doing now as well. So, a lot to be worked on, but the goal here is to save jobs, maintain, a high level of mail delivery service, maintain rural post offices, and that's what we'll be getting at, on Monday night.
Yep. And meanwhile, the cherry blossoms here in Washington, D.C. are blooming 2 weeks early.
Well, I'll tell you something, and I think many folks may not appreciate this. You know, after winter, everyone is delighted to see an early spring. But here in Vermont, and I don't know about the rest of the world, we have had in the last week days, I think March 21st, the weather was something like 12 degrees warmer than it had ever been on a March 21st. And that is freaky. Mm. You know, it's one thing to say, hey, this is the warmest day on record by 2 degrees, by 1 degree back in, you know, 1896, it was this, now it's a degree or two higher. 12 degrees is huge, and that's gone on for a couple of days in places all over New England. And we should be very, very apprehensive about what is happening. Because this is just not a nice early spring. This is a significant change in the ecology. It raises questions about what kind of water supply we're going to have if the snow is not there and melting into people's wells, raising questions about bug infestation. This is a big deal. Yeah. And so folks who think that global warming is not real or we should not worry about it, I hope they begin to pay attention to that reality.
Yeah.
There's another issue we have been working on very hard, and that is I think everybody who's driving in their car right now understands a couple of factors. Number one, the price of gas is going off the, going up very rapidly. And the issue here, as the New York Times reported on a major story today, the issue is not supply and demand. We have more supply today than we did 3 years ago when the price of gas was at $1.97 a gallon. And we're seeing more and more, despite our Republican friends' attack on the president, we're seeing more and more oil exploration and digging and drilling than we have seen for decades. And second of all, demand has gone down at its lowest point now since 1997, and that's true for world demand in the last quarter as well. Supply is exceeding demand by a ratio of 2 to 1. So I think the question is, if you have an ample amount of supply and you have a decrease in demand, why are oil prices spiking? And I think more and more people are coming to the conclusion that this has everything to do with Wall Street speculation on the oil futures market. And what everybody should understand is the oil futures market is not controlled, as you might expect, by people who actually use the product, right?
Right.
It is controlled by Wall Street speculators who are only function there is to make as much profit as they can, and that's what they're doing. That is one of the reasons why oil prices are spiking.
Yeah, and gasoline prices.
And, of course, gasoline as well.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be back with your calls for the senator in our National Town Hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. It's a great news resource, a genuine good news, great news resource. Plus, he's got a newsletter, and you can sign his constitutional amendment. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, the Tom Hartman Program, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Robert in Joliet, Illinois, listening in on WCPT, Chicago's Progressive Talk. Robert, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders and Tom. I wanted to ask real quick about your guys' opinion on the anti-protesting bill that President Obama signed a few days ago, and also the, essentially, in my opinion, martial law. Law, I don't, I mean, it's not kind of heavy, but I mean, the law that he signed where the government could take over, I guess, assets like food and water and so on and so forth.
Tom, are you familiar with what Rob's talking about?
Yeah, there was an expansion of areas that can be defined as secure areas, you know, and my understanding of it is, you know, like if the president goes to Chicago, they could say, okay, this five-block area is now the equivalent of the White House and has that level of security. Although, you know, other people have been interpreting this as just some incredible government overreach, but it was by and large supported by both Democrats and Republicans. So I've been scratching my head. I haven't had a chance to actually read
it. Honestly, I don't. Look, it goes without saying that the people of this country, from its inception, have First Amendment rights to express their point of view. They have the right of assembly. They have the right to protest. And I have been concerned that while it is absolutely imperative that we protect the security of the President of the United States, which is no small task, by the way, that people have a right to demonstrate and have their voices heard. So I am sympathetic, obviously, to making sure that people have that right.
Michael in Hinsdale, New Hampshire. Michael, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Bernie. Hello, Tom. How are you guys?
Great.
My comment is on the price of gas compared to the low fuel oil consumption of this amazingly warm winter. It seems obvious to me that the market is being manipulated by somebody on Wall Street in years gone by when fuel oil consumption has been low, the price of gas and fuel oil has dropped. And this year, fuel oil consumption has been very low, and the price has gone up, up, up.
Well, Michael, I think you make the right point. That's what I was trying to say a moment ago. The facts are pretty clear that the demand now, as you suggest, is at its lowest point, actually, since 1997 in this country. It has to do, I think, with maybe a warm winter. It has to do with the fact that the automobiles that we're driving, trucks we're driving, have better energy efficiency than used to be the case. There's a recession. People are driving less. But that is the fact. The fact is that demand is down and supply is up. And I think Michael's point is right, is that there are people who are manipulating the system, and I think those are our good friends on Wall Street who helped cause this recession. In the first place, so they agreed, and now they're back doing it again. And I would say, if I could just pivot off of that point, I mean, this takes us to a broader issue, getting back to Wall Street, and that is that we have got to rethink the function of Wall Street, the power of Wall Street. And I found it interesting. I think it was the Dallas Fed. Chairman of the Dallas Fed talked about, this guy is a conservative guy. Mm-hmm. And you know what he said?
He said the banks are too big to fail.
Making up these big banks.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something that we have introduced legislation to do, and I think the fact that maybe a conservative has come out and said that is the right thing. And his point was that we are right now in a situation where you have more danger of too big to fail than before Dodd-Frank, and I believe that's true. That despite the fact that we went through this horrendous bailout of Wall Street because these banks were so big, three out of the four largest banks are now bigger than they were before we bailed them out. And it's not only a question of too big to fail and having to bail these guys out because they would bring down half the economy when they fell, but it is also an issue of whether or not you have anything like a competitive free market economy. My conservative friends, my Republican friends talk about how competition is wonderful. Do you really have a competition, or the kind of competition you should have, when half of the mortgage industry is controlled by six banks, and six banks are issuing two-thirds of the credit cards in this country and controlling something like 65%, the equivalent of 65% of the assets of the United States of America.
Yeah.
And that is an issue that we do not talk enough about. But I do not believe that you're going to have long-term sustainable growth or a long-term improvement of the horrendous situation of the middle class today unless we deal with that Wall Street issue, and it is popping up right now in terms of speculation and the driving up of oil prices.
John in Madison, Indiana. We have just a minute to the break. John, quick question.
My question is for Senator Sanders is, why is our country so slow to progress in things that the rest of the world have already progressed to? As the voice of, to me, the voice of reason in our government, why is our government so slow to progress? Like, we are always the last one, it seems, to come around.
Well, John, that's a good question. It's not always the case, but too often it is the case. And the answer I would suggest to you has a lot to do with the power of big money in politics and the fact that the big money guys in this country have become increasingly greedy. There was always has been a conflict between, the private sector and labor, for example, but there was also an understanding that we were one nation and people had to work together. But now these guys at the top could care less about the middle class and working families of this country. If they can make a nickel more by shutting down a plant in this country, moving to China, not a problem. If they can throw off, lay off huge numbers of workers, that's fine. If they can manipulate the system, that's fine. So I would say that your point is that we are the only nation in the industrialized world not to provide health care to all people, far behind the rest of the world in terms of making higher education affordable, behind much of the world in terms of environmental protection. Unfortunately, you're right on those points, John.
We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United there, as well as sign up for his newsletter.
We got too complicated. It's all way overrated. I like the old and outdated way of life.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Jonathan in New York City watching us on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
I want to ask about the possible bringing back of Glass-Steagall with all the banks foreclosing on everybody.
Well, the answer is, Jonathan, I agree with you. In my view, the deregulation of Wall Street and allowing for all kinds of mergers between investor banks and commercial banks and insurance companies was certainly one of the reasons that we had the Wall Street collapse, which led us to the horrendous recession that we're in right now. Glass-Steagall was the Depression-era law which maintained a wall and a separation between those entities, and I think that makes sense. Dodd-Frank took us a little way forward but went nowhere near enough to provide the kinds of regulation that must take place on Wall Street. As I mentioned earlier, I would go further than Dodd-Frank. I think essentially this economy is never going to be protecting the needs of working families and the middle class, creating the kinds of jobs that we desperately need to pay people a living wage, unless you start breaking up these huge banks now that has such an impact both economically and politically on our country.
Ramona in Los Angeles, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I didn't know I was on the air yet. Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask you and Bernie about the state that has their own state-owned bank.
That's North Dakota.
With Dakota, and also why don't other, Los Angeles is in terrible trouble financially. I was wondering why other states don't do it, and if it could be done.
Well, sure, one more thing, Ramona. I think it's a good idea. I mean, North Dakota deserves a lot of credit for having a bank established. When was that? That's been how many years, Tom? That's been...
It's since 1918, 1919, yeah, 1909, right. Something like that.
And my understanding is it works pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
And here you have a situation where they make, my presumption is, they invest in their communities, and they help create jobs, and they make a profit, and so forth. The reason, Ramona, that you don't see more of that in this country, I think, is that a state-owned bank would be real competition to some of these large commercial banks. And they don't want to see that type of competition. But I think the concept is a sound one, and I certainly support it.
Walter, in Durham, North Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I just have a quick question concerning when will someone introduce some type of legislation that will help, that will regulate Wall Street in regard to speculation on commodities that people use, such as oil, wheat. That affects all Americans.
The essentials.
Well, Walter, yeah. Let me give you the good news is that someone has introduced that legislation, and that's me, and I think we have six co-sponsors. And what it says is that the Commodities Future Trading Commission, that's the agency that has responsibility to end excessive speculation in the oil futures market, do what they're supposed to do and use their emergency powers to do it. So that legislation has been introduced. We're trying to get more support, trying to get it introduced in the House as well. As I've said a moment ago, it is absurd that over 80% of the oil futures market is controlled by Wall Street speculators and less than 20% by people who actually use the product. And the function of the speculators is to make a profit, to buy and sell, to drive prices up, sell it when you can, and that's what they're doing. So I think Walter's point is right, but I'm happy to tell him that we have introduced that legislation.
Okay, and Andre in Westchester, New York? Andre, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom. First of all, Bernie, you are my favorite senator. I'll say that right up front. I wanted to make a point about speculation, but first before that, I want to say a little thing about Keystone, and something that's not really known to most people, in that currently there is a small glut of oil in the Midwest and basically the middle of the continent because of the success of the Bakken and the tar sands. Now, the plan behind Keystone was always to bring that oil down to the coast, all right, where there is you have refiners that are equipped to deal with it, but once
it's
on the coast, suddenly it's going to be exported, all right? And paradoxically, what will happen is the price of oil in the the price of gasoline in the Midwest will go up to match elsewhere. So this is another case of someone taking a project which sounds really nice and misrepresenting it for their own personal gains.
Well, I think, thank you, Andre. I think you're right. This oil is anticipated to be sold to China. There are some studies which suggest that it will actually drive prices of oil up in the Midwest. But to me, equally important to all of that is the fact that this nation must come to grips with the reality that global warming is real, that we've got to break our dependence on fossil fuel, that the alternatives are staring us right in the face. They are out there. The technology is there. We can make huge progress in terms of energy efficiency, both in our homes and our buildings and in our transportation system, and we can move rapidly to such sustainable energies as wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, other sustainable energies. The future of the planet is at stake. So your point, Andre, is exactly right, but in addition, it's imperative that we look at the implications for global warming about going into the tar sands.
Jim in San Antonio, Texas. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. My question relates to both Wall Street and the Postal Service. I'm wondering to what extent the Postal Service's problems are contributed to by the presence of junk mail and basically treat them as a subsidized arm of Wall Street, and if there's a plan to do anything about it.
Well, that's a good question, Jim, and I don't know that I know the definitive answer to it. There is some arguments that I have heard is that the Postal Service has not used the kind of flexibility it should in terms of its pricing, i.e. that some of the mailers, the people who are doing advertising mail, are getting a better break than they should. The prices could go up. More revenue could come into the Postal Service. But I think the argument for more flexibility, pricing flexibility for the Post Office, bringing in more revenue, is an important point to be made.
Paula in Carbondale, Illinois. Is this the same Paula who used to call in like 9 years ago when we started the program?
Yes, but I got banned for a while. I guess when you moved to Washington, D.C., your phone system changed.
Okay, well, welcome back, Paula. Question for Bernie?
Carbondale, Illinois, with the Post Office that's going to be shut down. Hmm. Yeah, my question was, and you kind of answered it, I don't understand how you can talk about global warming as a bad thing, and then talk about the price of oil going up as a bad thing. To me, it's a good thing when the price of oil goes up, because then less oil will be burned. They talk about, oh, well, what about the poor people? Well, they don't seem to be worried about the poor people when it comes to the high housing prices, which they're bound and determined to keep up. You know, and all everyone needs a place to live. Not everyone needs a car. So why is it they're trying to keep housing prices up when we have so many homeless? And then they want to keep the oil prices down so that people can sit out, you know, can drive, you know, unnecessarily.
I hear your point, and I don't know who the they is that you're referring to. I am concerned that in many parts of this country, including the city that I'm, where I live in Burlington, Vermont, housing prices are very, very high. And working families are spending, you know, 40%, 45% of their limited incomes on decent housing. And that's unacceptable, and we need to build more affordable housing in this country. In terms of the issue of oil prices, yes, I suppose that if you drove the price of oil way, way up, it would have an impact in preventing, in making people drive less, et cetera, et cetera. But I can tell you that in the world that we live in right now, in my state, you got tens of thousands of working people who have to drive to work. There is no option. And if they want a job, that's what they've got to do. They've got to get in their car, and they drive 20, 30, 40, 50 miles to work, and they drive back. And the question is, when you're making 12, 14 bucks an hour, can you afford to pay 4 or 5 bucks for a gallon of gas? And the answer is that you cannot. So the point is, it's not really a contradiction, Paula. Those of us who do understand the terrible threat of global warming understand that we need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel. How do you do that? Well, you start producing cars that get 50, 60, 80 miles per gallon. You develop public transportation. You move toward solar energy, wind energy, to produce the electricity that we need. So there are ways to protect working people without driving the price of oil up, which is just taking money out of the pockets of people who just can't afford to pay $4 or $5 for a gallon.
And the housing price problem, is this a banking problem, or is this?
Well, yeah, it may be. I'm sure everything is related to banking, but I think one of the crises that we face is there is just not enough affordable housing being built in this country, and that has a lot to do with how builders can get affordable capital.
Yeah, yeah. And that people's wages are collapsing, and they just can't afford so much anymore.
That's right.
Yeah. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more of our National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And visit Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, for great news, the Bernie Buzz newsletter, and Bernie's constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Sanders.Senate.gov is website. Mohammed in Chicago, Illinois, listening on Chicago's Progressive Talk. Hey, Mohammed, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
I think it's 5 p.m. on Chicago.
Mohammed? Apparently
yes.
Not. Yes, sir?
Yeah, I'm in. I'm
oh, okay.
Here.
Okay. Go for it.
Hi, Tom.
Yes.
How are you, sir? And I do have a lot of respect for you. You are a hero of mine. Mr. Sanders, just a comment. Maybe you could answer this in form of a question. I believe in the right wing in this country and the right wing in Israel. They both got together, and because Obama and Netanyahu do not see eye to eye, so they jacked up the price. They threatened to Iran, and that right away, the next day, the price of the oil just went through the roof.
So you think the increasing in price of oil is a conspiracy to hurt the Obama presidency?
Absolutely.
Okay. Bernie?
I have heard that. I don't know. I would get back to the point that I made earlier. I think our friends on Wall Street don't need conspiracy theory to drive the price of oil up. When you control over 80% of the oil futures market, and your function there is to make as much profit as you can. When we've seen a significant increase in recent years about of the percentage of oil controlled by speculators on the oil futures market, I think that explains a whole lot. So I'm not quite into that conspiracy theory. I think there are reasons why oil prices are going up. I don't think there's some kind of great conspiracy out there.
Soledad in Austin, Texas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, I wanted to ask him or actually make a statement about health care. I recently went to the physician, and when I got to the front desk, they says, what is your deductible? I called my insurance company, and they says, you have to pay $1,900 out of your pocket first before you actually meet your deductible. So this is why I think that the health care debate is an interesting thing. I mean, the average person can't afford $1,900 to pay that in order before they start to do their deductibles. And fortunately, thankfully, I could do that, but not the average citizen can do that. And the last thing I was going to say is everything continues to increase. However, people's wages are flatlined, so I don't understand.
Well, that makes a very good point, and it's a point that should be made more often. And that is, you know, in the country, our country today, we have 50 million people who have zero insurance, no insurance at all. But what we also have are many, many millions of people who are in exactly the same position as Soledad is, and that is with very high deductibles and high copayments. And those people, while they ostensibly have insurance, that insurance isn't worth a hell of a lot if you can't afford the deductible. And one of the things that we should be forever ashamed about is that in America today, about 45,000 people die every single year, Tom, because they don't go to a doctor when they should. And one of the reasons is they just cannot afford to pay that initial bill. It may well be a case of high deductibles. It may be a case of no insurance whatsoever. But clearly, we have a dysfunctional healthcare system. Will the healthcare reform bill passed a couple of years ago improve the situation? It will. Does it go as far as it should? No, it does not. The United States, in my view, and I hope the state of Vermont will be moving in that direction, should join the rest of the industrialized world and move towards something like a Medicare for All single-payer program, which guarantees health care to all of our people. And when you do that, by the way, you also address the problem of why it is that we end up spending almost twice as much per person on health care as any other nation. It's funny, a couple of months ago, Tom, I had a bunch of kids from the UK, from the United Kingdom, in my office, and I asked them about health care in the UK. They don't even have a card. They walk into the doctor's office. They say, hi, I'm Mary Smith. You know, the nurse checks off the name. They go in, they see the doctor, and they leave. That's it. That's it. And that's one of the reasons why their health care costs are a fraction of what ours are, because they don't have the whole bureaucracy of billing and spending, you know, 25-30% of every health care dollar on administration, on advertising, and all that other stuff. So in my view, you know, a caller earlier in this program asked, why is it that we're so far behind many other countries in so many areas? Well, health care certainly is one of those areas. It has everything to do with the power of the private insurance companies, the drug companies, but we have got to make sure that health care becomes a right of all people, that we don't end up continuing to pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, for health care in general. We can do a heck of a lot better. I hope the state of Vermont will lead the nation toward a single-payer program.
Wendy in Bethel, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. We've got about a minute and three quarters until the end of the hour.
Okay, I'll try to be quick. Thank you, gentlemen. I have been kind of forced into a bad situation financially. We haven't had any income, and I have a 401k that I've been slowly drawing down. There are two potential fixes I can think of. One is, well, to introduce legislation to do either one or both, to eliminate the 10% penalty would be really helpful. But also, there's a provision that you can return the money into the account, I think once, but it has to be within 60 days. And if that were extended, you know, either indefinitely or for a year, that way if we...
Okay. Wendy, we just have 40 seconds left. Let's get Bernie's thoughts on this, okay?
Wendy is raising an issue that we have heard previously on the show, Tom. In hard economic times, when a lot of people are not employed and their income is way down, they want to go do their 401ks. They want to be able to do that in a much easier way than they can do it now and without penalties. And I think Wendy's point is a good point. It is something that Congress should work on.
Is there any effort in Congress to do this?
There is some discussion, yes, there is.
And where will that come from?
Well, it will come from people who are listening to the problems that Wendy and many other people have.
Yeah.
In hard times, if people are sitting on money that they can't access, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay. Final thoughts for the week? Oh, I'm sorry, Bernie. We just ran out of time.
Okay.
I know your final thought. Despair is not an option, right?
That's final thought.
Okay. Senator Sanders, thank you so much for being with us. Great talking with you, Bernie. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, Mitt Romney has... welcome back, by the way. It's Anything Goes Friday, and your calls on any topic you want. But there's a few topics I want. One of them is, today is the second-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Originally, it was Obamacare as a slur by right-wingers. Increasingly, it's Obamacare as a celebration by pretty much everybody who thinks that this guy gets credit for being the first president since Lyndon Johnson passed Medicare to really make a significant and positive and meaningful and useful for we the people change in our healthcare system. So, second anniversary, Mitt Romney decides to celebrate it. How's he going to celebrate it? He's going to lie about it. No, I'm serious. He comes right out and he just lays down three lies. Here's the first one.
And we've just learned from the CBO, it's not $1 trillion. It's more like double that. Obamacare is massively more expensive than had been originally estimated.
Well, that's a flat-out lie. In fact, according to the CBO, they just determined that the Affordable Care Act is going to cost $50 billion less than originally estimated. I mean, I don't know if he's just making this stuff up because that's what Mitt Romney does, or if there's some right-wing think tank that's feeding it to him and saying, well, if you assume that the economy is in recession for the next 112 years and nobody's salaries go up and inflation is at 16%, but there's no increase in payments, then go over those 112 years, it'll cost an extra trillion. You know how they play with numbers, right, over at the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute, all these think tanks. I don't know where he came up with this number, but according to the Congressional, but he's crediting the Congressional Budget Office, and that's a lie. They did not say that. In fact, they said that it's going to be $50 billion less. And this is quite mind-boggling. Here's his second lie.
30% of employers said they're going to drop the coverage for their employees when Obamacare is installed.
Right. Okay. From the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog today, the rebuttal to that. Romney's claim that 30% of employers will drop coverage comes from a study conducted by McKinsey, which, after stirring much controversy, promptly walked back its projection. In fact, they said this was not intended as a predictive economic analysis of the impact of the Affordable Care Act. The CBO projects that 3 to 5 million employees may lose coverage. In other words, they'll go on personal coverage instead of getting it through their employers. They're still covered. While surveys of employers have found that the vast majorities of businesses continue to plan to offer insurance and, in fact, are going to be doing it through the exchanges that the Affordable Care Act sets up, so it'll cost them less. Gee, what a novel idea. And here's his third lie.
The Catholic Church is being told that they have to provide insurance that covers morning after pills, sterilization, and contraceptives, despite the fact that these very features violate the conscience of the Catholic Church itself.
No, not so much, Mitt. There's a specific religious exemption in the Affordable Care Act that says that churches that don't like any of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act don't have to comply with them. Now, if a church wants to run a non-church business, you know, where people don't go and pray, if they want to run a bookstore, if they want to run a hospital, if they want to run a nursing home, if they want to run a car factory, if they want to run, well, in the case of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, food factory, Loma Linda Foods. You know, if they want to do a business which is not being a church, then that business has to comply with the law just like any other business, but that's just common sense. I mean, what are you going to say that if some sheikh from Saudi Arabia comes over here and decides to start a window and door manufacturing company in Chicago, that he should have the right to force all of his employees to pray six times a day because he thinks that Sharia law or Islam is the, you know, come on. So here's Mitt Romney celebrating the second anniversary of the Affordable Care Act by lying about it. It's, you know, when you think about that, when you consider the, you know, actually how serious this is. And the other thing, have you heard about the terrorist incident in the United States this week? I'm not talking about Trayvon Martin, although that probably falls close to that category. And, well, frankly, it falls into that category if you're African-American. Absolutely. I mean, all the people that we had calling into this program yesterday, African-Americans saying, you know, I am afraid for my child to go out. But there was also a firebombing of a state senator's office in Texas. Now, don't you think that the national media would go his state? You know, if somebody from Al-Qaeda, you know, this guy in France, for example, who killed seven people, it was reported up until today, it was reported hysterically and breathlessly that he was part of Al-Qaeda. Turns out he's got nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. He might have thought Al-Qaeda was cool, but they don't know him, and he doesn't know them. He was a nutcase who killed a bunch of people, an anti-Semitic nutcase who killed a bunch of Jews. And that, you know, and had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. But it was hysterical news, particularly on Fox News. Fox News and the right-wing talk machines, they went nuts with this thing because they thought he was, you know, this guy's a Muslim and he's killing people. Okay, so can you imagine if a guy wearing a turban and shouting Allah Akbar had thrown a Molotov cocktail at Texas State Senator Wendy Davis's office and burned it? I mean, burned the door? I'm looking at a picture of it here right now, which I can't show on the screen, I'm sorry, but you can see this over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. Don't you think that an elected official, a state senator in one of the largest states in the union being firebombed, a terrorist firebombing would like be major news? Well, not so much, because apparently the guy who firebombed her office did so because she had said something favorable about Planned Parenthood. So it's not a terrorist incident. Now, yeah, I understand that, you know, the legitimate debate in the United States and discussion about abortion. I get it. And I think that I've said this many times. The technology has not kept up with the law, and in fact, I think Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided to begin with. Essentially, the Supreme Court made law, and you know my opinion on the Supreme Court making law, whether it's Roe v. Wade or whether it's Citizens United. And I think we have to have a national conversation about this and work it out, all of us together, or at least all the women in this country together. But this is a whole, when you start firebombing things, that's a whole different thing. That's got nothing to do with the issues of abortion or contraception or Planned Parenthood or anything. That's terrorism. And yet it wasn't, you know, it's not called out as that. I just find it extraordinary. Just extraordinary. Meanwhile, Brazil. Here's another story. This is probably the most underreported story of the last week and a half. Week and a half ago, well, actually about back in November, the Brazilian Navy was on patrol and they discovered an oil slick. They tracked it back to its source and they discovered that 3,000 barrels of oil had been spilled out of a Chevron well into the waters of Brazil. Last week, they took the passports of 17 Chevron and Transocean employees, including the CEO of Brazil, Chevron Brazil, who's an American. And yesterday they announced that they're charging these guys with crimes And each one of them is facing 31 years in prison. That's for spilling 3,000 barrels of oil. The oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, 4 million. Maybe as much as 7 million. Plus, 11 men were murdered. Has anybody been arrested in the United States? Have we taken anybody's passport? No, Tony Hayward came over here and said to Congress, hey, you guys, basically. This is amazing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Robert Greenwald will be with us. Stick around.
The Kochs would like to buy the world and make it all their own. It's grown too full of free ideas to really feel like home. Let's focus on the simple things like lower tax for all, and hope no one notices where the greatest benefit will fall. Yes, we finance the Tea Party and talking heads you'll trust, and hope the working folks don't see it helps out mostly us. We're the real thing.
Yeah. You know, it must be bizarre to be that famous. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Robert Greenwald on the line with us, the filmmaker, political activist, founder of Brave New Films, bravenewfilms.org, the website, and the newest website, KochBrothersExposed.com. Robert is going to be here in Washington, D.C., where we are right now live on the air on two different radio stations. He's going to be live here in D.C. Soon. Right, Robert, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Give me the date. I don't have it right at the top of my...
In Washington is going to be Monday, April 2nd.
Okay.
And we're premiering the film in New York, Washington, Harvard, Los Angeles. But most importantly, with all the films, and, you know, you've been an amazing part of this outreach, is everyone can get their own copy at KochBrothersExposed.com. So that we can begin to take democracy back from the billionaires.
There you go. And it sounds like a good plan. How do we do it, Robert?
If you go to the website, you can do it on Facebook. You can go to the website. You can just order a copy of the DVD. You can have a house party. You can watch it. You can give it to a union, a church, a school, any place that you think people will gain and profit intellectually and emotionally, and profit for democracy, not profit financially the way the Koch brothers do, and help us spread the word. And, you know, it's been a consistent pattern, Tom, with all the films that you've been so critical with, from, you know, at Fox to Walmart to Afghanistan, is people getting them, people saying this is important information, and then either screening it or giving the DVD or passing it on.
So get over to KochBrothersExposed.com right now. Robert, give us a few tantalizing tidbits here. What are some of the things that Koch brothers are up to?
Well, what's been fascinating and, of course, troubling, Tom, in the year and a half that we've been investigating, that Jeff and Natalie and Joseph and the whole team working on this have found all kinds of ways that they use their money. And they use it to advance their economic self-interests, and they use it to advance their ideology. So there's a whole sequence where David Koch talks about being a cancer survivor, and we have hard, firm evidence of a small southern African-American community, which Georgia Pacific, who Koch brothers own, is literally giving these people cancer. And the sequence is heartbreaking and powerful. But it shows what happens when money trumps everything. We have a sequence around their buying up the House Committee on Energy in order to make sure that there are no restraints of any kind. We have a whole section on, which I think is one of the most interesting things we've done, about how an echo chamber really works. You know, we hear that all the time. But on the Social Security echo chamber, we do the research showing that their think tanks have written over 200 different papers, all arguing the fallacies and the falsehoods about Social Security. Then we literally see those words from the papers being put in the mouths of pundits who they pay for, and then elected officials who they fund. So So it, you know, it cuts across the gamut. And of course, we've got a wonderful interview with the guy in Wisconsin who pranked the Kochs and got David Koch on the line. You know, so there's a variety of interesting.
The guy who got Scott Walker on the line pretending he was David Koch, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is like, you know, the Mutt and Jeff. I mean, this is the story of two men who just happen to be worth what, $40-50 billion, something like that, some incredible amount of money.
Yep.
And they're literally modifying the government of this country and public opinion, and have been doing so successfully and largely under the radar for how long?
Oh, for years and years. I mean, David Koch ran for office actually back in the 70s, but it was at that point he realized, and there's a wonderful line in Jane Mayer's very important New Yorker article about this, and David Koch said he realized that politicians are actors. They read from a script, and what the Kochs want to do is write that script. And that's what they're doing, and they're doing it with their billions, for the most part under the radar, but hopefully the work that we and Li Fang and you and others are doing will help bring that into the public consciousness. And that's why the film becomes, you know, it's good to make a film, but it's only important if people see it and use it as a way to spread the word. We'll never have their money, you know, we know that, Tom, right? But what we do have is people using the social media, using Facebook, using Twitter, using clips and using the movie to say, hey, here's what's going on.
You know, and I think the California elections of 2010 might give us some hope. You had Carly Fiorina and Meg Whitman, both multi-millionaires, coming in and saying, well, you know, we'll just buy the election and drop $100 million of my own money, $50 million of my own money, and massively outspend their opponents, Jerry Brown and I believe it was Barbara Boxer, wasn't it?
Yep.
And the people caught on to it.
Yes.
The people said, okay, we figured out what's going on. And that's the power of waking people up, because it immunizes them to the propaganda. And that's what you're doing so brilliantly, Robert Greenwald, and it's why it's so important that people get over to Koch Brothers. And then, by the way, Koch is spelled K-O-C-H.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Don't try the beverage. You know, it's K-O-C-H, Brothers Exposed.com. Maybe in the future you should also get the website with the brand name. Yeah, I mean, who knows? Anyhow, Robert Greenwald, the founder of Brave New Films, with another, you know, knock it out of the ballpark, a movie that you need to get, you need to see, you need to hold a block party, you need to invite your friends over, you need to pass it out. Get over to KochBrothersExposed.com and check it out. Robert, thank you for the great work you're doing.
Thank you, Tom, for the great partnership, as always.
It's great talking with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday, back with your calls and more. Oh, I got to tell you, did you know the New York Police Department's watching progressives?
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Cheryl in Florence, Oregon. Hey, Cheryl, what's on your mind?
Hey, I'm so glad to get through to you. Sorry I missed talking to Bernie Sanders, but regarding the post office debacle, I've been listening to the, the discussions about it for months. But because I live in Oregon, we vote by mail.
100%.
Yes. I'm very, very concerned about closures. We've had one rural post office close nearby here already. I know that all the decisions aren't made yet. I heard Bernie Sanders allude to some meeting on Monday night, and that I think in May they're voting on, you know, exactly how many post offices and whatnot are, will be closed and so forth. But as a voter in Oregon and representing voters, you know, from other states that vote by mail, I'm really alarmed that nobody in the media has brought this to the attention of anyone as another tactic at voter suppression.
Mm-hmm.
because where I live, it's a fairly small rural community, but a lot of retirees.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
Who, you know, are used to certain, you know, ways of mailing their things and
sure.
doing things that are perhaps hard for them to adjust. So the fact that this information is not getting out there from state officials that I try to call here, they seem kind of like, oh, really? You know,
yeah.
I guess we better start thinking about it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I would, you know, to turn a liberal state like Oregon around with something like that. Yeah, I'm just saying
I'm not sure, well, Cheryl, if I may, yeah. that I'm not sure that yeah. this is like a political conspiracy vis-a-vis Oregon,
no,
because
no.
most of the conservative parts of Oregon are the rural parts, and those would be the parts that would be impacted the worst, and so it might actually work to the benefit of progressives in Oregon. On the other hand, though, nationwide, the people who disproportionately vote by mail, who vote absentee ballot, are people who are
right.
housebound or people who are elderly. And
right.
those people tend to vote Democratic. And, in fact, they tend to be on Social Security. And it's either Social Security disability or Social Security retirement. And therefore want to preserve it. And therefore are horrified by people like Paul Ryan. And so in that regard, you could argue that it's voter suppression. But I think it's just a good old-fashioned let's take out the union. Because this is the largest, the Postal Service Union is the largest, the Postal Service is the largest unionized, the largest employer in the United States is Walmart, which is not unionized. The second largest employer in the United States is the U.S. Postal Service, which is unionized. And that, in my opinion, is why they were targeted. Cheryl, thank you for the call. I got to move along here. We got a whole bunch of callers here. We'll get them all in. Clifford in Ishpeming, Michigan. Hey, Clifford, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was going to ask, or I was going to talk to Bernie about it, but then, I didn't get on at 74. My mind wanders a little bit. I happen to think of this. You know, the Republicans are blaming all this gas prices on Obama.
Right.
Well, you know, I think we ought to try this and get behind them and do what you call nationalizing. That ought to be. In 1951, Truman tried to nationalize the steel industry, and the Supreme Court told him that
the what industry?
Had,
with the what industry?
The steel industry.
Oh, steel. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you said seals, yeah. And I was like, what?
No, no.
Okay.
The steel
yeah.
industry, okay. And the Supreme Court told him that he couldn't do that. That only Congress could do that.
Right.
Well, you know, with election time coming and everybody wanting votes, I mean, we should have a whole pile of congressmen behind. Nationalizing the oil.
Well, and we don't even have to nationalize the industry. We can simply nationalize the oil. We can say, you know, any oil that's more than 5 feet below the surface of the ground belongs to the United States of America, period. And those mineral rights are ours. Or if somebody has mineral rights by contract, they have to share those mineral rights with the country. This is what country after country around the world has done. And of course, when Iran did this, we overthrew their democratically elected president. When Iraq did this, we overthrew their democratically elected president. When Hugo Chavez did this, we tried to overthrow him a couple of times. And so it's pretty unlikely that we're going to do it ourselves, but I think it's a great idea, Clifford. Thank you for the call. Jeff in Longmont, California, listening on AM 760. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Longmont, Colorado.
Longmont,
Colorado.
It's a great
day out here.
Yeah.
It's a great day out here, except, they're fracking like they're possessed right out east of me.
Oh, my.
And polluting the air because that stuff off gases like you won't believe.
Yeah.
So I have a little coincidence that Rachel Maddow pointed out, this stuff with Mitt Romney being like an Etch-a-Sketch.
Right.
The company that owns Etch-a-Sketch.
Ohio Arts moved their manufacturing to China in 2001. Is that
right.
where you were going?
And they moved their manufacturing to China because of pressure to produce a product that could be bought cheaper, and the main source of the pressure was Toys R Us. Toys R Us is owned by Bain Capital.
Oh, my.
Ouch.
Oh my! I didn't know that.
Go to Rachel Maddow and check it out.
It's yeah, no, I believe it. If Rachel said it, I believe it. Jeff, thank you for that. That's amazing. So Mitt Romney's Bain Capital brought us Etch-a-Sketch being outsourced to China. Duh. Stephen in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I really love and respect the work you're doing. I've heard your comments today about BP and the Gulf. Mm-hmm. Heard your comments yesterday about the possibility that the right were rattling swords in Iran to drive oil prices up. I heard Robert's comments about the Koch brothers. You know, as much respect as I have for Senator Sanders, Congressman Sanders, I don't have any problem at all thinking that the oil companies are working to keep oil prices up. After all,
right.
They told Obama that he would pay a price for standing up against the pipeline, and I notice he's compromised a bit in Oklahoma. A lot of people here in Taos are really up in arms about that.
Yeah, with the southern extension of the Keystone XL pipeline. I agree, Stephen, and you know, I understand where a United States senator has to be very careful about stepping into the realm of conspiracy theory. I don't have to be quite so careful. I'll just say it right up front. I think
you know,
that the oil company is trying to get a pound of flesh out of Obama, and they're doing it by jacking up oil prices. And I think the banks are in on it, and they're largely responsible for it, and they're both making money doing it. So, hey, exactly. They win twice. It's a twofer.
And, you know, I think it's an illustration for the American people of how the right can control both the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yes.
Look at Obama. If he doesn't compromise on this, they keep oil prices up, and he runs the risk of losing the election. If he plays ball with them, he loses support among liberals and progressives.
Yeah. No, he was put in one of those awful positions where he would lose either way he went, and so he did the middle ground, the compromise, where he loses the least on both sides, but he's still going to lose on both sides, and it's a real tragedy. Frankly, I think both for his campaign but more importantly for this rapidly heating planet. Stephen, thank you for the call. Well said. Desmond in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Desmond, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Like the person who preceded me, I just wanted to say that I had heard about the firebombing of State Senator Wendy Davis's office in Texas on the Rachel Maddow show.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got family that lives in Fort Worth, one of them being my daughter-in-law. And she had been struggling for some time with getting health care, particularly prenatal and postnatal health care, which is the whole issue of the Planned Parenthood.
Right.
At the time when she was doing it, she was single. And I was in correspondence with her, and I told her, I said, you know, you need to write your state representatives and your federal senators and complain about this because health care was still a major argument then. And she was working three jobs and said she didn't have time. And I told her, I said, you know, I understand what you're saying. I said, but the people who are getting your tax dollars have free health care. You're paying for it. She thought about it, and she wrote them. And the only person who really responded to her was Kay Bailey Hutchinson.
Mm-hmm.
And when she got the response from her, she forwarded it to me, and I called the senator's office. And they had nothing good to say about health care. But I basically worked over the representative that answered the phone with a lot of the talking points that I've learned listening to progressive radio. And you just have to stay activated. But it's a real issue.
Mm-hmm.
The salary base out there is crazy. The benefits are extremely expensive and very prohibitive. The co-pays or deductibles are astronomical. And that's why we need single payer.
Yeah. Absolutely. This is the point that, you know, I had a conservative on the program a couple of days ago going, oh, you don't want to do away with the health insurance companies, do you? After all, I mean, they're part of the American infrastructure. They're American corporations. They're
no,
all
they're
American.
Not.
And I'm like, yeah, get rid of them. You know, they don't exist in any other country.
That was ginned up under Nixon. And when he did it, he said that the people will end up paying more. And it's true.
Yep.
We've ended up paying more.
Yeah, we now have the Nixon tapes where he actually was having conversations with health insurance industry executives, helping come up with the idea of HMOs as a way to actually increase the profits for the health insurance industry so that they would give him more money to get reelected. Gee, what a novel idea. Leave it to Richard Nixon. And here we are all these years later, and it's still in place. The only country in the developed world with a stupid healthcare system that costs us twice as much as anybody else pays. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more of your calls. And we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service to find out what's going on in the rest of the world today. minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, by Ellen Ratner and Anne Gaiman. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world?
Well, there's plenty up in the world. One thing that is up, the topic that just will not go away, the killing of Trayvon Martin. President Obama, when he was in the Rose Garden this morning, nominating the next World Bank president, he hopes, was asked a question about Trayvon Martin and responded. Clearly, he was ready for this and it seems wanted to speak out and spoke personally. And when the president speaks personally, it's always very powerful because it seems quite rare. And he said, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
Yes.
And this this is quite an extraordinary statement, really, for the president to make.
It is. And it's also true. And that's one of those moments of, you know, oh, my God, you know. We talked about this. We've talked about this for much of the last 2 days' programs. And I've had so many African-American parents call in and say, this is the conversation that I have with my children. You know, be careful. It's not a safe world for you, or at least it's not a safe country for you. And you know, we have to behave differently than people who have white privilege, than the whites. And white Americans need to get this. And I don't think most do. Anyhow, end of sermon. What else is going on?
The president leaves the country tonight, which is interesting optics, seeing as the president's health care overhaul will be argued before the Supreme Court starting for 3 days on Monday. Mm-hmm. He heads to a summit on nuclear security in Seoul, South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And he will head to the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, on Sunday, where he will visit American troops.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be very interesting because Pyongyang in North Korea has warned in pretty bellicose terms that it would regard any discussion of its nuclear program at the meeting as a declaration of war.
Hmm.
Well, I mean, quite honestly, no matter that the ostensible reason for the discussion is to talk about loose nukes, things like that. North Korea and Iran are going to very strongly loom over this meeting.
Yeah.
I think that they're going to just have to get used to this idea that they're going to be discussed.
Yeah, I think they're already there.
Yeah, I think they're already there. Now, what was another interesting thing, I asked Jay Carney today, which is the greater threat to global security, North Korea or Iran?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, we don't rank them.
Yeah.
But with regard to North Korea, what they've done on nuclear weapons and with Iran, obvious violations of their international obligations, and both have actions by both regimes that threaten stability and the nuclear stability of the globe. So that was why he said the administration is so focused on preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons and working with the allies to get North Korea to give up its nuclear program.
Mm. Good.
Meantime, the Kim, the man who has been nominated by the president to be the next head of the World Bank, Jim Yong Kim, president of Dartmouth College, has got quite an extraordinary background. He is not a banker, he's not a diplomat, and he's not an old foreign policy hand.
No, he's got an MD and a PhD in anthropology.
That's right.
Yeah, which is remarkable.
That's right. He's known as a real force with the global health community and is really widely admired. He's somebody who has run a nonprofit, provides health care for the poor, former director of the Department of HIV/AIDS at the World Health Organization. He also helped to develop a treatment program for multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, the first large-scale treatment of that disease in a poor country. And those treatment programs are now in place in more than 40 nations.
If you go back to the founding of the World Bank, the rationale for it wasn't like the creation of the Fed to stabilize currencies and regulate monetary policy and things like that. The reason the World Bank was created was basically to create a better world, to help countries through economic crises, to help countries develop, to bring them into the modern world. And so I think this is probably the single best appointment that President Obama has made in the last 3 years.
It's a really interesting appointment, and it heads off a lot of the criticism that he's going to get from developing nations.
Yes.
And finally, and very briefly, Obamacare. Well, it's now official. The Obama campaign, as of today, is calling its supporters to embrace the Obamacare label and start using it themselves.
Good. I've been calling it that for 6 months now, saying, hey, you know, if all the right-wingers are going to use it, I think that President Obama should get credit for, being the first president since Lyndon Johnson. I mean, to really make a significant change in our healthcare system. Harry Truman tried back in the 40s, couldn't pull it off. Franklin Roosevelt tried, couldn't pull it off. Teddy Roosevelt tried, couldn't pull it off. Richard Nixon tried and couldn't pull it off. I give him credit for it.
They say it's about time we give it the love it deserves. Let everyone know. I like Obamacare.
There you go. Okay. And what else is up?
Finally, House Democrats are lining up behind a ban on pink slime in school lunches. As you may know, pink slime is given to school children. Now the USDA has offered them an option. It's a mix of beef scraps treated with bacteria-killing ammonia and added to ground beef products.
Yeah, it's not even quite beef scraps. It's like gristle and cartilage.
Critics say it's made up largely of non-meat issues, and in fact, Burger King and McDonald's won't use it. So Democrats are now trying to get it banned by the USDA. The USDA is saying, well, look, we're giving schools an option. Democrats say that's not good enough. What you're doing, in fact, is you're setting up a two-tiered lunch system so the poorer schools will get pink slime and wealthier schools will get ground beef.
Yeah, and that's true. And it shouldn't be. And this was the decision made by a USDA director who was the appointee of Ronald Reagan. Surprise, surprise. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stanford City Commissioners, no vote of no confidence. The Chief of Police, Bill Lee Jr., has resigned. Mitt Romney is going to have a hard time digging out from his Let Detroit Go Bankrupt. And frankly, I think the Etch-a-Sketch thing, though, is going to get him more. This I think is going to haunt Romney the way that the actually manufactured out of nothing comment from the Republican Party. Well, in a way, there's probably a parallel. Heard Al Gore, and that is that Al Gore actually once said that he had worked on the legislation that brought about the modern day internet, which is actually true. He helped write the bill that created what we call the internet today. The original DARPANET, this military and intercollege communication system. He worked on the committee, helped write the bill, he voted for it. But that got turned by the Republicans into Al Gore saying, I invented the internet, something that he literally never said. But it haunted him and hurt him. Was the old saying, a lie can get all the way around, I think it was Mark Twain, a lie can get all the way around the world before the truth gets its boots on. Well, similarly, Mitt Romney never said, I can change my positions the way you can shake an Etch-a-Sketch. He never said that. It was some guy who's a strategist on his campaign who was being interviewed by John Fugelsang on CNN. John of the Stephanie Miller Show and the Sexy Liberal Tour and all that other cool stuff. And in fact, here it is.
Is there a concern that the pressure from Santorum and Gingrich might force the governor to tack so far to the right it would hurt him with moderate voters in the general election?
Well, I think you hit a reset button for the fall campaign. Everything changes. It's almost like an Etch-a-Sketch. You can kind of shake it up and we start all over again.
So, that was like, 3 days ago, I think it was. And the day after that, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich and Ricky Santorum were showing up with Etch-a-Sketches. And yesterday, Ron Paul rolled out a new campaign ad with an Etch-a-Sketch in it. And, you know, I remember CPAC back 4 years ago when Mitt Romney was running for the Republican, you know, in the Republican primaries, principally against John McCain. And at CPAC, they didn't like him at all. And it's a conservative political action conference. And I was doing my radio show from there, as I've done for years and years and years. All these people were walking around wearing these giant flippers, right? And a guy was dressed up like a dolphin, you know, and it's because they were saying Mitt Romney flip-flops. I have a feeling that the thing that is going to haunt him now is the Etch-a-Sketch. And this incredible irony that apparently Rachel Maddow tracked down, that the Ohio Arts, which is the company that's been making Etch-a-Sketches since long before I was a wee one, used to make them in Ohio. And in 2001, they got so much pressure from Toys R Us to offer a lower-priced Etch-a-Sketch that they moved their manufacturing to China. And Toys R Us is one of the companies that was owned by Bain Financial, which is Mitt Romney's company. So it all comes full circle. Mitt Romney pushes Etch-a-Sketch to outsource the jobs to China. I mean, it's quite remarkable. And I think I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. Sneezing on the air, not a good thing. So anyhow, back to your calls. Robert in Northeast Maryland. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. For all you do, buddy. I heard something pretty disturbing. I heard that Canada, if there's any civil unrest in America, that the Canadian Army could come on our school and help put down the civil unrest, and the American Army could go to Canada and help them put down their civil unrest.
Yeah, it's not true.
They're trying to work on that with the
not true, Robert. It's not true.
Not true?
It's not true. No.
Okay.
If either country's army were to invade the other country, it would be an act of war. Canada and the United States are sovereign nations. I've seen the emails. In fact, I've seen emails saying that Obama set it up, right? And back during the Bush administration, I saw emails saying that Bush set it up and that this was all part of North Atlantic Treaty or North American Treaty, and Mexico's army could run our country. None of that's true. Go to Snopes.com and you will see it thoroughly debunked. Robert, thanks a lot for the call, though. And this is the thing. I mean, there's so much misinformation out there. I got an email the other day that said, did you know that Jupiter got global warming? Mars has global warming. Pluto has global warming. You know, quack, quack, quack. Well, actually, you know, Mars rotates on its axis. So, yeah, the ice is melting on the northern part, but the southern part is getting colder. And Pluto is got an elliptical orbit, and it's coming into the area where it's closer to the sun. But this had a whole list of all these planets that were getting warm, and turns out that none of them are, you know, or other than those two. And those two are doing it because of the way that they rotate around the sun. It's got nothing to do with, you know, hey, everybody's getting warm, including the United States. No, sorry, it's another lie. You know, when you get these emails, check them out against Snopes.com, and always be skeptical. Always be skeptical. Bob in Ashland, Alabama. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind? Bob? Bob's not there. Okay, Mark in Eureka, California. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Have you read that article from Matt Taibbi in Rolling Stones?
I've read many of them. Which one is this?
It's the latest one about the bankers are buying property in bulk.
Are you talking?
And they're running out the property.
Right. Yeah, you're talking too crook to fail. What the banksters are doing is they're saying to people, okay, we're going to foreclose on your home, and you know, you paid $400,000 for this house, and you got, you know, $20,000-$30,000 in equity, but it's only worth $300,000 now. So we're going to foreclose on it, and the bank actually makes a profit on that foreclosure. They get a tax write down, they get a bonus from the federal government, and they get to keep the equity that the homeowner put in originally. And then after they foreclose, they say, oh, would you like to rent this? We would be glad to rent this house to you. And you know, while we're trying to sell it to somebody else. And so people get to stay in their homes, but now they've lost all that equity. And I haven't read the piece, word for word or thoroughly. I am familiar with it. And it's, you know, it's like the banksters. You know, it's just a scheme a minute. What Franklin, and thanks for calling and mentioning this, Mark, what Franklin Roosevelt did when people were losing their homes was he said, okay, we're going to take the mortgages out of the hands of the banksters. And he created the Federal Home Mortgage Association, I think it was called, something very much like that. And he said, you know, you've got, because most people back then had five-year balloon payments on their mortgages. And, I mean, it was a relatively new thing. Before the 19-teens, people used to just buy houses for cash or not buy. And so people had these exploding mortgages from the roaring 20s. And so what Franklin Roosevelt said was, the federal government will loan you the money, we'll pay off the bank, and then loan you the money on a 30-year note at 2% or 3%, very, very low interest rate. And now you've got a payment that you can afford, and over the lifetime of yourself and the next 30 years of the house, you'll end up owning it. And you know, and then after World War II, they did the same thing through the Veterans Administration. My dad bought the house that he died in, that I lived in most of my life, that way. And so, anyhow. Keith in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Keith, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Yes, Tom. Say, I was a stock options trader for years, and people talk about the oil future speculation. They never talk about raising the margin requirements. I mean, that would be absolutely simple. If you would raise the margin requirements from, I believe right now, if you're a professional trader, you only put down 10%.
Yes, they're 10%.
If you put down 50% or 100%, there go your traders.
The problem, Keith. That's something that is determined by the Commodity Futures CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Correct.
Right. And they have not been willing to take these steps, it's a problem, and I frankly don't understand why. I think that they should, and Bernie thinks that they should. So, Keith, thanks for the call. You're right.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything goes Friday, and Obamacare turns 2 years old today. Mitt Romney's response? Lies. Friday, Tim in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I've just been thinking about this situation with Brazil, you know, really throwing the book at these oil executives. You know, it seems like I've been thinking, you know, I know you say despair isn't an option, and I agree with that. Maybe I should move to Brazil, because it seems like democracy is an exporter over there. Our philosophical underpinnings in a country have, migrated over to a different place.
Brazil does not have a Supreme Court that has said corporations are people and money is speech. And Brazil has some of the toughest campaign finance laws and anti-corruption laws in the democratic, small d democratic world, you know, among democracies. And in fact, it's going to be my daily take tonight. I got this whole rant about it. And as a consequence, in fact, let me give you a quote here from, this is from The Economist, from an article, February 25th, 2011, just, you know, earlier this year. It was titled The Money Trail. Brazil has strict campaign finance laws. Brazil is blessed with competitive and aggressive media and tenacious institutions that investigate such campaign finance scandals revolving around the public prosecutor's office, a semi-autonomous part of the federal government, and its local equivalents. Where money, politics, and scandal meet in Brazil, there is usually a camera somewhere nearby to take the pictures that will make any later profession of innocence ring hollow. In other words, not only is it a crime for Brazilian politicians to do what American politicians routinely do, taking money from corporations, doing the will of rich donors, moving through the revolving door. Not only is that a crime in Brazil, but they've got a press that is like just aggressively looking for it, because it's one of those, you know, it becomes a scandal and it's like, this is what their tabloid newspapers are all about, is politicians getting caught with their hand in the cookie jar or corporations getting caught trying to corrupt politicians. And that's why you've got the American citizen, the American who's the head of, what is his name here? George Buck III, an American citizen who is the head of Chevron's Brazil division, has had to surrender his passport to the police because, you know, hey, you guys committed a crime here. And he and these other guys, they're looking at 31 years in prison. Whereas Tony Hayward, you know, the CEO of BP, he comes over to the United States. And this is over a 3,000-barrel oil spill in Brazil. Tony Hayward dumps 4 million barrels of oil into our Gulf of Mexico and kills 11 people, or he has complicity in the death of 11 people. And he comes over and Congress says, oh, whatever, rah, 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 and then he goes, pfft. You know, he just basically, you know, thumbs his nose at them, blows them the raspberry, hops on his private jet, flies back to the UK, and is living happily forever after in his mansion. And it's because he can buy politicians. Even though he's a foreign citizen and it's a foreign corporation, BP can buy our politicians in the United States, and Chevron, an American company, cannot buy politicians in Brazil. And so the political machine in Brazil is putting the oil criminals in jail. Dan, Tim, we got to do something like that here in the United States. Dan in Sterling Heights, Michigan, listening on AM 1310 WDTW. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Happy Friday.
Thank you. Same to you.
I just want to say thank you. Thank you. So happy with your time change here in Detroit. I actually look forward to my drive home now.
Great. Well, thank you.
So, hey, I wanted to talk a bit about Apple and their $100 billion, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like it's sort of died down, and I've never really got much press, but it caught my eye because if Apple had employed even non-unionized but American workers to make all of their wonderful products, that $100 billion would have been in the pockets of middle-class families.
Well, Apple would still probably have profits on the order of $50 or $60 billion. They would be slightly less profitable. And by the way, about half of that profit is being held offshore because if you've got offshore manufacturing and you've got, you know, local purchasing, you can, because you're selling to yourself, your offshore division is selling to your American division, you can set the price at which you sell to yourself. So you can sell to yourself very expensive offshore, keep all your profits offshore, and even generate losses here in the United States and reduce your U.S. income taxes. It's amazing how the system gets gamed. And now Apple's leaning really hard, among other companies, on the U.S. government to let them bring all that profit into the United States and not have to pay income tax on it.
Right. And then they turned around, and it was a side story, I think, for the most part. But they're taking half. They're taking $50 billion, and what they're doing is either buying back stock or increasing their dividend.
Right. Well, they're doing both.
Right. And but you look at that and you think, who's that money going to?
It's going to the investors.
Absolutely. And the majority of the investors in Apple stock, I would argue, are people that fall into the top 1%, if, you know, at least the top 5%. And so it's just another,
sure,
albeit long, circuitous mechanism of wealth transfer from what should be the middle class to the 1%.
Yeah, I agree with you. The majority of stock in the United States, and I believe, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I believe it's more than 80% of all stock in the United States is owned by the top either 1% or 5%.
I
get in trouble when I give absolute numbers, so I'll qualify those. But it's in that neighborhood.
Right, and I just the last point is I just want to urge progressive minded people and certainly liberals and anyone who is in favor of the middle class to really think about your smartphone, really think about your...
Well, here's the problem, Dan. There are none that are made in the United States.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean, here's your choice. You can buy an Apple phone that's made in China. You can buy a BlackBerry that's made in South Korea, I think, or something like that. You can, you know, I'm not sure where all of them are made, but almost all of them are made in Southeast Asia, in South Korea, in Japan, in China, in Taiwan. And, you know, it would be really great if there was an American manufacturer. Oh, and then there's a manufacturer in Germany. There's a company in Germany that makes, I think it's not Nokia. That's a Japanese company. But one of the Philips, I'll bet it's Philips, is, you know, manufacturing in Europe, but nobody's making, you know, cell phones in the United States. So, and we developed the technology, right? I mean, we developed the integrated circuit. We invented the transistor. We developed the technology, and we don't make them here anymore. Tell me our trade laws aren't insane. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to WDTW.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, more of your calls and the good, the bad, and the amazingly new vocabulary word ugly.
Thank you.
Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very trictotillomaniacally ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good. The California Assembly. The California State Assembly voted yesterday to endorse a constitutional amendment to repeal the infamous Citizens United Supreme Court decision. Since the ruling, corporations have had unprecedented influence on the American democracy and have corrupted the political process. All across the country, towns, cities, and states have passed similar resolutions condemning Citizens United and its destructive influence on government. Time for everyone to stand up against corporate influence and tell Congress to amend the Constitution to overturn Citizens United. The bad. The New York City Police Department. New documents released show that NYPD officers have attended meetings of liberal political organizations to keep intelligence files on political activists who plan protests around the country. This is not the first time the NYPD's counterterrorism tactics have come under fire. In the run-up to the 2004 Republican convention, police monitored church groups, anti-war organizations, and environmental advocates all across the nation. And the NYPD is also under investigation for its controversial stop and search processes. It seems to me the NYPD is more committed to preventing free speech than stopping terrorism. And the very, very ugly Geraldo Rivera. In the wake of the Trayvon Martin tragedy and controversy, Rivera decided to add more fuel to the fire. On this morning's episode of Fox and Friends, Rivera said, "I think the hoodie is as much responsible for Trayvon Martin's death as George Zimmerman." Rivera went on to say he blames Trayvon's parents for letting him go outside wearing a hooded sweatshirt. He told the show's panel that, "I am urging the parents of black and Latino youngsters, particularly, not to let their children go out wearing hoodies." So rather than denounce the actions of the police, call out Alex's role in the tragedy, at the very least show some sympathy, Rivera chose to make the situation worse by playing a ridiculous blame game, a variation on "she wouldn't have gotten raped if she hadn't worn that dress," and that is very, very ugly. Besides that, when it's raining out, I mean, it just makes sense to go out wearing a hoodie. Come on, give me a break. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's on your mind?
Tom, I'm thinking about a solution for Obama's response to the oil companies. And I think he should just attack their subsidies, their tax.
He's tried.
Subsidies, and just drum it in again and again. That he should attack the health care costs that the oil companies dump on us. And one of the worst one, of course, the cost is the lead tetraethyl in the
correlation. Yeah, although tetraethyl lead is no longer in our gasoline.
And you've noticed the crime rate is dropping. The violence, personal violence crime rate has dropped in correlation with the outlawing of lead tetraethyl.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, the direct correlation. In fact, England was the last place to outlaw it, and their crime rates have started to drop also. It's a better correlation, or it's as good a correlation as carbon use and temperature rising.
Wow. It makes sense. I know it causes brain damage.
I would suggest also that Brazil should be more concerned with the great Amazon sea that will develop as the both poles melt, and the destruction of such a large piece of Brazil.
Yeah. I'm guessing that they are, although I...
You wouldn't think there'd be any oil drilling.
No one has been able to go that step. But here's what they are doing in Brazil. More than half of all the cars on the road in Brazil are not running on gasoline. They're running on ethanol. And all cars in Brazil, by law, have to be flex fuel. They have to be able to run on either ethanol or biodiesel or gasoline or diesel. And the conversion is very inexpensive. It's less than $100, but that's all the cars in Brazil now. So that's a big deal. Dwayne, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Raleigh in Vashon Island, Washington. Hey, Raleigh, what's up?
Oh, it's actually Wally, not Raleigh.
I thought he
got that wrong. Anyway, Tom, happy Friday to you.
Thank you. And to you, too.
And I have a comment. I realize that it's a lot of fun to, call Mitt Romney a flip-flopper or... Mr. Etch-a-Sketch, it has a wonderful visual to it. But I think he's a very serious and very dangerous man. And he has core principles that he does not vary from. And they are to enrich the wealthy and to give more power to the wealthy. Now, look at it this way. say I'm over at your house, and you're a big Cubs fan or watching baseball. I don't really care about baseball. Well, I'm going to root for the Cubs with you.
Sure.
Next week, I'm over at Laura's house, and he's a Dodgers fan, so we're rooting for the Dodgers. But it doesn't really matter to me because I don't care that much about baseball. I'm just having a good time at your house.
Mm-hmm.
That's Mitt Romney. But if you listen to him, every speech he makes, he's talking about the economy that the wealthy people in this country have.
Yes.
And he doesn't care about these other things. They don't really
Well,
matter.
This is a guy who
he
was born a multimillionaire. This is a guy who is, just like George W. Bush, this is a guy who was born a multimillionaire, has never had the experience of being anything other than a multimillionaire, and wants to make sure that he has a country that is safe for multimillionaires. I mean, it's really quite simple. Wally, thanks a lot for the call. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, a good friend of mine, over the years, we have tried to understand the correlation between what we pay at the pump for gas and how much the price of a barrel of oil is.
Right.
And it never makes any sense because I do remember back in 2008 when it was $140, $147 a barrel, we were paying $4.15 a gallon for gas.
Right.
The new correlation is, and the media doesn't tell this one, is what the wholesale price of gas closes at. Now, oil went down to $104 a barrel yesterday, and gas only went down about a dime.
Okay.
The wholesale price of gas, though, and this is only going back a few months ago, the difference between the wholesale price and what you paid at the pump was about 30 cents. And if I believe what he told me yesterday was right, the difference yesterday was 90 cents to a dollar.
Wow.
That's where the
Wall Where are you getting these numbers from, Mike?
You go online and you look at what the wholesale price of gasoline was.
Okay.
The local radio station only tells you, and you got to be up at like 4 o'clock in the morning or at the end of the day.
Right.
What they tell you what the price of a barrel of oil costs.
Right.
Because if it was $147 a barrel back in 2008, and it was $4.15. Why is it $104 a barrel and we're paying $4.35?
Yeah, well, it's because the oil companies are basically a cartel. The oil companies are a monopoly, just like the big ag companies are a monopoly, just like the big media companies are a monopoly, just like the clothing industry, the retail clothing industry is a monopoly. I mean, there is virtually not an industry in the United States that has not been formed into a cartel, into a group of four or five or six companies that basically control the industry, cell phone business, the ISP business, the cable television business, you name it, they have been cartelized, and that's why American consumers pay through the nose for pretty much everything. I mean, we're paying five times the developed world price for internet access and cell phone use, for example, because of the cartel. And similarly, we've got a cartel with the gas companies, and it's something that came about, and thanks for raising the issue, Mike. This all started in 1982 when Ronald Reagan instructed the Justice Department to stop enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and we got this explosion of middle-sized companies that used to be competing with each other suddenly merging to become giant companies that no longer have to worry about competition because wink, wink, nod, nod, let's fix the price. And, you know, the game of Monopoly was invented back in the 1920s just to illustrate how this works. If you've ever played Monopoly, you know how it works. That's what's going on. Henry in Macon, Georgia. Hey, Henry, what's up?
How y'all doing today?
Good. What's in your mind?
Look, I wanted to really call to Bernie Sanders earlier, but I would like for you to propose a question if you ever get a chance to him. And the thing is, you know, y'all was talking about jobs and stuff here in America and how corporations keep them here. And they talking about, man, I don't know if you remember, a few years ago they passed that job bill where they can get technical workers to corporations here in America.
Yeah, you're talking about the H-1B visas.
That's right. Check.
Yeah.
See what they can't do to rescind that because
Bernie,
technical workers here, they're graduating from colleges and community colleges, but they can't find a job because all these people overseas are taking the technical worker jobs, and I think it's time to repeal that act.
Yeah, I am with you, and I can tell you that several people over the last couple of years, Bernie's been doing our show for 7 years now, he's been asked this question many times, and every single time he has said that he is opposed to expanding, and in fact he thinks we should radically contract the number of these H-1B visas out there, that there's, as long as there's a single unemployed engineer in the United States, it's insane to be, you know, bringing more engineers in from outside the country. Marianne in Bemerton, Washington. Marianne, we have a minute to the break. You wanted to make an announcement, though, right?
Wonderful. Thank you. Happy spring.
Thank you.
I'm at Bremerton, Washington, and our Occupy movement is joining with our county, Kitsap 99%, mm-hmm. and we're having an event all day tomorrow, kind of a different take on things. The local Native American Tribal Center has invited us in, and your friend David Corton is going to speak, and Fran will be there. Yeah, they're fabulous.
When, where, and how do you find it on the web?
It's at events, with a plural, events.kitsapcommunity.org.
Okay, and when and where is it going to be?
At the Port Gamble Tribal Center, 10 a.m. to 6. Bill Moyer with
what
from
day?
The Backbone Camp tomorrow. Saturday.
Okay, great. Marianne, thank you very much, and good luck. Say hi to everybody for me.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That guy has a nasty habit of stepping on me. We'll be back with more of your calls in just a minute. Who is that guy?
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Julie Lulley, to our writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global on commercial radio stations all across the nation, Pacifica Radio on nonprofit stations all across the country, in Europe and in Africa, on Free Speech TV, which carries us on a Dish Network and DirecTV, on all our cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and all the others around the country, to Don Rojas, Dennis Trunov, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and all the great folks at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and most importantly, to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Thank you genuinely, sincerely. KC in Cathedral City, California, listening on KPTR. Hey, KC, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm out here in the desert, California desert. And anyways, I've been seeing commercials once in a while about popular vote. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, I don't know much but about electoral college, but it seems kind of like keep your eye on the peanut. You know, like, why don't we have popular vote?
Yeah. KC, you're breaking up. Here's the bottom line. First of all, you've got a bunch of Republicans who are saying, well, let's have the popular vote. Let's do away with the Electoral College, but let's do away with it first in the blue states. Because then, see, right now, if California, 51% of Californians vote for a Democrat, then all those Republican votes get thrown away. Whereas if you do away with the Electoral College and have a national popular vote in the blue states, then all those votes for the Republican presidential candidate will be counted. So you've either got to do the entire country all at once or nothing at all, number one. And number two, I'm not so sure I'm ready to get rid of the Electoral College, because if you did, then you could run a presidential campaign basically in about 12 or 15 major cities and ignore the rest of the country. And I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing, although it might work to the benefit of Democrats. It might. But, you know, I'd rather see our electoral system changed by having instant runoff voting nationwide, ranked voting. They do this in Australia. They do it in New Zealand, who both have the similar kind of, you know, voting that we have, first past the post, winner take all, and it works just fine. Rich in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom, a while ago you were talking about a white paper that was put out during the Nixon administration, basically saying that they were afraid of us in the middle class and to get rid of the middle class.
Yeah, this was the Powell memo is what I was talking about. Lewis Powell wrote it in 72 or 73, and it was a letter he wrote to his best friend and next-door neighbor, or a close friend and next-door neighbor, who was the president of the American Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. And you can easily read this thing online. It's no secret.
Okay. No, I didn't. I just couldn't remember what guy it was, and I wanted to send it to
Lewis
somebody,
Powell.
And making me crazy.
Three months after he wrote it, Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court, and then he began actually doing it on the Supreme Court.
I was at a press conference today with Jan Schakowsky, Richard Durbin, and Ms. Davis. For the second anniversary of healthcare.
Yep.
The moving stories there of people that this thing has helped. And with me, I got three boys, and they were able to be covered after college, one of them, and one of them's in college. So
that's great.
They got to fight to keep that thing in place.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, I think that all this chest thumping by the Republicans about how they're going to repeal Obamacare, once Americans figure out what will happen to them if you repeal Obamacare, all these people, you know, the donut hole is going to get opened back up for seniors. Young people are no longer going to be on their parents' insurance policy. Children right now can't be denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions. And starting in 2 years, you and I can't be denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions. And when people realize that they're going to lose all that, if Mitt Romney does what he says he's going to do, or any of these other Republicans, I don't think they're going to go for it. Rich, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for raising the issue. James in Champlain, Illinois. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I just got a quick quote from Sam Walton, and then I'll get to my point.
Okay.
Sam Walton once said there's only one boss, and that's the customer. And he can fire everybody in this company from the chairman on down simply by spending his money somewhere else. That's an absolute fact, and Bank of America learned that one the hard way. Anyway, the reason for my call. I retired in 2000 from a number one automaker in America. I went to D.C., and I spent some time with the Senate committees teaching some of their people statistical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say I appreciate your show, and a lot of what you say is true. But having sat with those people, I have to say that they work for the campaign contributors,
sure,
which, as we all know, is the top 1%. And I'll give you a perfect example. They don't care. I don't care if they're Democrat or Republican. I'm telling you, they don't care about us.
Well, there are some exceptions. Bernie Sanders is one of the notable ones. Dennis Kucinich was. Sherrod Brown is. I think that there is a small, Jan Schakowsky, Dick Durbin, there's a relatively small but very real list of senators and members of the House of Representatives who actually are representing the people and who are supported by small contributions. And now in this post-Citizens United era, it's more important than ever that we support these people. You know, $5, $10, $15, $25, whatever. The Supreme Court, I just lost it. Coming up on Monday, the Supreme Court is looking at Obamacare, and I'll be broadcasting live right across the street from the court and talking to people who are fighting to protect our health care on Monday. Members of Congress, doctors, health care workers, and more. And so it's going to be a hoot. Our Supreme Court radio row on Monday. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. I'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.